Welcome to the Saxophone History Podcast, a thoughtful, researched, and slightly irreverent look at the history of our instrument. I'm your host, Andrew D. Meyer. Our bass player, Eugene Wright, plays very well, is on a diet, and wears a size 48 suit, and signs, "God bless you, Eugene Wright," in autograph books. I usually write, "Paul Desmond, there's no God," so as to leave people with the right feeling of futility. That's a quote from a letter that Paul Desmond wrote to Duke Ellington whilst on tour in Europe. When we left off, all of the members of what would soon be known as the classic Dave Brubeck Quartet had assembled. That's Paul Desmond on alto saxophone, Eugene Wright on bass, Joe Morello on drums, and of course, Dave Brubeck at the piano. The group was also just about to set off on their first world tour. Organized by the State Department, the tour included performances in the United Kingdom, the majority of continental European capitals, and across Turkey, Iran, Iraq, India, Pakistan, Ceylon, which I think is Sri Lanka now, and Afghanistan. Desmond did not travel with the group to Iran, Iraq, or Afghanistan because he identified himself as a Jewish person in his visa declarations and was therefore not allowed into those Islamic countries. Instead, Desmond and Sue Saul, who was Jewish, traveled to Lebanon during that portion of the tour. Interestingly, Desmond was able to travel to Pakistan for some reason with the group. Like, Pakistan was just like, yeah, come on in, but Afghanistan was like, no. These State Department-sponsored tours were part of an initiative designed to foster closer relations with the United States, dating back to the 30s, when the program was developed to counter the Nazi cultural export program. Basically, in the 30s, the Nazis began an incredibly well-funded program throughout Latin America that was designed to show sort of like an alternative path to U.S. hegemony. And also it was designed to drive a wedge between those populations and U.S. influence through the export of German art and performance. These programs, which were originally packaged by Nelson Rockefeller, were somewhat small affairs until the Cold War years, where the United States really ramped up its efforts to spread its influence around the globe. The Brubeck Tour, while certainly not the first of its type, was definitely the first time a jazz group, which, you know, is possibly the most American export. This was the first time that a jazz group had ever been sent behind the Iron Curtain. I can just imagine Paul Desmond in like East Germany and in Poland. Here's this daydreamy intellectual cat who, you know, clearly loves a bit of comfort coming face to face with the hard-nosed life, you know, under Soviet rule. Luckily, he had his portable typewriter with him, and indeed, his description of traveling through East Germany is quite amusing. This is another one of his sort of stream of conscious, slightly rambling descriptions of things. I think these are just hilarious. Ramsey's book has loads of them in it, and I'm just going to read exactly what Desmond wrote. Quote, "Arrival hysterical. Spooky ride through East Berlin about 9 p.m. Trite observation, I know, but crossing border like time machine. Space warpsville. Train station like subway to purgatory. Sturdy, but not unfriendly-looking women taking tickets. Walking around with those wild-looking conductors' lanterns attached to their waists. Like glass bird cages with candles in them. No interpreter this part of trip, hence many good-natured charades in German, Russian, Polish. Customs, curious at one point about what was in the black drum cases, disturbed when Dave explained, boom, 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 beamed when caught on. Fellow with currency declaration form had difficult time with Gene Wright, who wanted it understood that he didn't want to bother with any foreign exchange. Dave paid all his expenses and Gene just played the bass, had no cash. The guy kept pointing at the line for Gene to sign where it said, money, and Gene kept writing, no money. And the guy kept tearing them up and giving him new ones. Finally, he gave up. Much neurotic conjecture, also, about where to get off. Long discussion in next compartment between old conductor and members of troupe. Every so often, everyone would chime in together on the word alles, one of the very few in our common German vocabulary. As the night wore on, it began to sound something like one of those folk songs with lots of choruses, unquote. I particularly liked the part about the group having long discussions about where to get off the train. I think anyone who's traveled in a country where the language is very different from your own can probably relate to that one. Also, it's such a universal thing that when you only know a couple of words in a language, anytime you hear them, the whole group just like naturally says them, you know? Like anytime someone says alles, which I think means all or everyone, right? You know, the whole group is like, ah, alles, alles. Very funny. About the traveling, Eugene Wright recounted later that as he naturally enjoyed organization and order, he was always picking up Desmond's saxophone or his typewriter when they were changing trains or leaving hotel lobbies. After they'd left, Desmond would have like a little freak out that he'd left his saxophone or whatever behind, and Eugene would be like, no, you're good. I got it right here, man. When in Sweden, a radio DJ told Desmond that American musicians coming through either want to talk about socialism or ask where the girls are. Desmond claimed to have been in the first camp on that tour, and it sounds like he found European women perhaps a bit intimidating. He mentioned how the stewardesses seemed to speak about 12 languages and better English than those at home, and that he didn't seem to be able to talk to anyone, which is kind of funny, you know, knowing his reputation. Writing home from England, Desmond told that the tour was a great financial success with very receptive audiences, but musically, he felt that it left something to be desired. He complained a lot of Morello's playing and suggested he felt the group didn't have much of a future. He even said in a letter to Mort Saul that Brubeck was so happy with Morello that it would be fine for him once Desmond found something else to move on to. It's a great irony that the group's biggest success, largely fueled by a Morello-Desmond collaboration, was yet to come, but that's a story for later. Also very amusing in his letters home from the tour are Desmond's descriptions of England. He says the English have a desire to live in the past and laments that it is very difficult to find food after midnight or coffee at any time. He also describes the general lack of heating, which some 70 years later, I can confirm is still basically true here. And he says that Sunday afternoon in London makes Philadelphia look like Mardi Gras. While in India, the group had many encounters with local musicians. Desmond recalled that he and Brubeck found much Indian music to be rather puzzling, since harmony is almost non-existent, at least in sort of the Western understanding of that music. Brubeck had already developed an interest in odd time signatures, so the rhythmic complexity found in Indian and Turkish music was very stimulating. Keep in mind that this tour was in 1958, only 1 year before Time Out was released. The music on Jazz Impressions of Eurasia was largely inspired by the 1958 tour and was recorded upon their arrival at home. In 1959, Desmond wrote what would become the greatest selling jazz single of all time, Take Five. Ironically, throughout his career, Desmond wrote very little, despite frequent encouragement from Brubeck. Andre Previn, who was a friend and great admirer of Desmond's playing, said that considering how structured Desmond's solos were, he found it surprising that the saxophonist didn't compose more frequently. It seems that Desmond, who was known to avoid anything that required effort, just preferred the spontaneity and ease of improvisation over composition. Take Five was the first jazz instrumental single to sell 1 million copies. When the quartet had finished recording Time Out, Columbia Records was very unhappy with the result and released it only on condition that the next record would consist of more conventional material. As a result of the corporate distaste for the record, Columbia did very little in terms of promoting Time Out, making its success even more remarkable. The story of Take Five's composition is rather unremarkable, however. Morello had requested that the group do a tune in 5/4 time, to which Desmond wrote two melodies. Brubeck arranged them into the ternary ABA form, and that was that. Desmond considered it to be something of a throwaway and didn't really give it much thought. He claimed to have nearly traded the rights to Take Five for a Ronson electric razor. Not surprisingly, Desmond found it annoying to be asked about the brilliant inspiration that that created the piece throughout his life. So he would make up little stories about it, like that the tune was based on the sounds a slot machine made. Desmond claimed, and I believe rightfully so, that the bridge, or B section of Take 5, is what really makes it work. The contrasting melody and increased harmonic activity is the perfect counterbalance for the harmonically static A section. Doug Ramsey describes the bridge as a chromatic reduction of the opening phrase of the Johnny Burke, Jimmy Van Heusen popular song Sunday, Monday, or Always, which was a 1943 hit for Bing Crosby, and a piece that Desmond frequently quoted in his solos. I'm not sure what he means by chromatic reduction exactly, but with Desmond's well-known ability to quote from all sorts of sources, it's not surprising that his compositions might contain elements from popular song. While Take 5's commercial success may have been a surprise for Desmond and Columbia Records, Doug Ramsey points out that only a few years later, the tune likely would not have been able to find the same kind of success. As the charts and radio formats became more segmented and marketing efforts more targeted, the chances of a quirky tune like Take 5 being pushed by radio DJs who did so, you know, more or less because they just liked it, would have become much less likely. Although Desmond did make a lot of money from Take 5, he let the publishing rights go to Brubeck's company, Dairy Music, rather than keeping it for his own company, Aardvark. I suspect that this reflects how Desmond thought very little of it upon its completion and simply let Brubeck have it. Desmond was the highest paid sideman in jazz from 1960 to 1988, thanks to the composer royalties for Take 5, but the publisher's share went to Brubeck through his company, Dairy Music. Copyright law, which is somewhat mysterious, at least to me, transferred the publisher's share for U.S. sales to Desmond's estate in 1989, but outside of America, the publisher's rights still belong to Dairy Music. When he died, Desmond famously left all of the future royalties to his music to the American Red Cross. It's estimated that the organization receives over $100,000 a year from the gift. Despite receiving substantial fees for performances and a steady stream of record sales, in 1960, Dave Brubeck was still basically broke. He somehow owed $10,000 in back taxes. He was in kind of a weird position where he had to keep touring relentlessly because he needed the money to support his family, but the touring schedule meant that he rarely saw them. Brubeck's lawyer/accountant suggested that he rent his California home out and move to the East Coast, where the bulk of the group's work was. Part of the problem for Brubeck was that every time they had to go to the East Coast to play, it took so long to get there, remember they're like driving most of the time, that he felt like he wasn't really seeing his family enough. Brubeck ultimately decided to buy a house on 20 acres of wooded land in Wilton, New York. Wilton is it's a small community about 45 minutes north of Albany. Desmond also made the move east to a rather different location. He subletted his flat on Telegraph Hill and took up residence at 55th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan, or as he called it, Ground Zero. It's a pretty amazing location, really, and it's where Desmond would live for the rest of his life. It's right in between Radio City Music Hall and Carnegie Hall. It's four blocks from the park, and there were loads of clubs, restaurants, theaters, and the like nearby. You can just imagine the sort of social and cultural life that a young, successful jazz musician would have had in that location. Around this time, Desmond approached George Avakian with the desire to record as a leader. Avakian had left Columbia Records to develop the pop records side of things at Warner Brothers, but jumped at the chance to make a record with Desmond as the leader. In keeping with his earlier agreement with Brubeck, Desmond avoided using a pianist for the sessions and instead began what would become another long-term collaboration. This time, Desmond would find a sympathetic partner in Jim Hall. Hall had first heard Desmond with Brubeck at the Finney Hall concert at Oberlin in 1953 and had since finished school and made a name for himself working alongside Chico Hamilton, Jimmy Giuffre, and Ben Webster in Los Angeles before moving to New York and becoming a fixture on the scene. Rounding out the rhythm section for these sessions were Percy Heath on bass and Connie Kay on drums of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Released in 1960, First Place Again, Playboy, is the first of five quartet records with Jim Hall, and it's sort of Desmond's first major statement outside of the Brubeck orbit. The cover of the album is a photograph of a section of bleachers at a football game holding up colored signs that form together to say, in giant letters, "First place again!" This was a reference to Desmond's recent victories in the Downbeat polls and an effort by Warner Brothers to make the most of signing an artist who is, you know, in that position. But Desmond, of course, hated it. Really, I mean, if you think about it, it's like the most un-Desmond-like kind of image. Here's this really urbane cat who's known for like wry wit and incredible sensitivity in his playing, and the album art is just sort of like a meathead, like, "We're number one" sports imagery. I don't know, I find it very funny. This period in 1960 is kind of an interesting time for Desmond and the Brubeck Quartet because it's in the middle of this weird gap between recording Time Out in 1959 and Take Five becoming a major hit in 1961. The group would have had no way of knowing that they were about to become hugely famous and also very wealthy. They would have just thought that they recorded an album, you know, sort of as usual and moved on to the next thing. And they did, in fact, do several rather interesting things in this little gap. The quartet recorded Dave Brubeck's brother Howard's composition, Dialogues for Jazz Combo and Orchestra, with Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. I hear this album as a sort of natural large-scale expansion of the earlier Brubeck octet work, maybe. The group also recorded an album in 1960 with Count Basie's former singer, Jimmy Rushing. Rushing's bluesy style seems to have inspired Desmond on this record, whose playing is filled with bluesy tinges, whether he's soloing or playing the obbligato parts in the arrangement. I think it's fair to say that the explosion in popularity of Take Five changed the course of the group with the incredible demand that it created. It's interesting to think about whether the group might have gone in a different direction were it not for the Take Five fame and perhaps pursued more of these like third stream projects, you know, like they've done with the New York Philharmonic or who knows, like some other interesting collaborations. I also think it's interesting that they were able to record, you know, with the New York Philharmonic before their fame from Take Five. Like, you know, they were an in-demand group at this time, but they weren't, like a big household name like they were after Take Five came out. The success of Take Five also meant that neither Desmond nor Brubeck would be heading home to the West Coast anytime soon. Desmond wrote his father to tell him that he wouldn't be coming back to San Francisco for the foreseeable, and received a response that he should, quote, "return when he could live off his investments. Until then, there's nothing for you here but the weather," unquote. So Desmond settled into his busy life at 77 West 55th Street, which could arguably be called like the cultural capital of the world at the time, maybe. I mean, at least in the jazz world. For Desmond, living in this neighborhood meant a busy social calendar consisting of everything from hitting all of the best restaurants in the area to calling up Gloria Steinem to walk him around the Museum of Modern Art on LSD. Desmond's relationship with writer and feminist activist Gloria Steinem is another example of his ability to keep his life compartmentalized to a high level. Desmond and Steinem dated for a while and were friends for years after. Both had difficult relations with their mothers, who suffered from mental health illnesses in their childhoods. Yet, as Ramsey describes in an interview with Steinem, Paul never spoke about the difficulties with his mother, and it never came up in their relationship. It's kind of weird. Like, the two, you know, they both had this kind of rather unique experience of dealing with their mother's mental health problems at a young age, which were both, like, to a pretty extreme degree. And rather than using those memories as like a, you know, a common shared thing, a bonding element, they chose to keep them quiet and never realized that the other had really similar experiences. That's just a really good example of how Desmond, you know, kept parts of his life just segmented off from other areas. George Avakian, who took Desmond to RCA Records, set up a much vaunted opportunity for Desmond's first record on the label: the chance to record with strings. Though much desired, few jazz musicians got the opportunity to solo with orchestral accompaniment, largely due to the cost. I mean, think about the difference between bringing a quintet into the studio, arranging a dozen standards more or less on the fly, and walking out with the tapes, versus hiring a string orchestra, getting the right arranger, a copyist to make the parts, rehearsing the orchestra, booking a larger room, more engineers, you know, the list goes on. You can see why only truly top-tier players like Charlie Parker, Chet Baker, Clifford Brown, Coleman Hawkins, Benny Goodman, Stan Getz, and now Paul Desmond were afforded this extravagance. Desmond requested Bob Prince to do the arranging, and the five sessions required to make the record began in June of 1961 and finished in March of the following year. Prince recalled that Desmond didn't want to see his scores or hear a piano reduction or anything in advance. He preferred to go into the studio and experience the orchestral score as something of a blank canvas and just react to it spontaneously. Ramsey points out that the 2002 release of the record features extra takes of Autumn Leaves and Imagination, on which Desmond virtually never repeats ideas from earlier takes. I think the success of this recording is really a testament to Desmond's sensitivity and incredible ability to spontaneously create these very melodic lines. It would be easy for someone to go in not really knowing how the arrangements sound and come out with a very mediocre milquetoast result. But as Ramsey points out, Desmond and Hall don't just nail the arrangements, they subtly nudge the swing feel forward. The album was not received well critically, which is not surprising as jazz critics rarely like these orchestral albums. Years later, writing in the All Music Guide, Richard S. Jenall did describe the album as, quote, an undeniably classy entry in the make-out jazz genre, unquote. There's no doubt in my mind that Desmond would have really appreciated that review and would love to be associated with the make-out jazz genre. While life in mid-60s New York certainly meant a busy social diary, Desmond was also working steadily during this time. The jazz scene had begun to move towards concerts as being the dominant way for successful artists to make money, with the club scene becoming fractured and with the increasing pressures from folk and rock music. You can think about like the scene in the Village and stuff in New York. Despite this change in the scene, which we now know was a harbinger for things to come, the Brubeck Quartet was in great demand. And as Desmond said, quote, working as if it were going out of style, unquote. Despite this great success, both Brubeck and Desmond were thinking of disbanding the group. Brubeck because he was sick of the travel, and Desmond because he was interested in pursuing writing, as in writing words. And changes in career would have to wait for the time being, as the group was just in too much demand to quit. In 1961, a two-week engagement in Jamaica, which Desmond claimed was put together to, quote, buck up the natives, unquote, began his love of the Caribbean. Desmond was known to frequent the highly exclusive Sunset Lodge Beach Club in Montego Bay and would frequently have long drinking sessions there with the likes of authors Kurt Vonnegut and James Jones. Desmond's close friend Carl Gurevich, who taught him to love baseball in New York and traveled to Jamaica with him, described how Desmond would bring his records with him and give away autographed copies, likening him to Jack Kennedy on the island. Gurevich also describes how Desmond would take his reel-to-reel tape recorder with him and says that he was fascinated with Jamaican music. Gurevich says that he and Desmond would go up into the hills and Desmond would set up his recorder and jam with local musicians. He says Desmond wouldn't play his tunes or standards, he would just try to work his way into whatever these local guys were doing. I wonder how much truth there really is in these tales. I mean, it's pretty wild to think of Desmond, this super white, super urbane East Coast intellectual, jamming, in these weird trench town shacks in Jamaica. Actually, it does seem in keeping with what we know about him, however strange the scene would have been. This was in the early 60s, so it's kind of before reggae was really a thing. I guess these guys would have been playing like ska and probably some sort of Afro-Caribbean folk kind of stuff, maybe. Unfortunately, there are no surviving tapes of these excursions. Of the Caribbean life, Desmond said, quote, "Out of all the places I've been, which is far too many, Jamaica is my favorite, especially for all the really important things in life," unquote. Which meant, you know, writing, playing, drinking, pursuing romance, and basically just floating around in a pool on an air mattress. In 1962, Desmond went into the studio with Jerry Mulligan for four sessions at RCA, which resulted in Two of a Mind, another in Mulligan's pianoless quartet series. Composer and arranger Gary McFarlane spent some time with Mulligan and Desmond during these sessions and described how the puns and witticisms were flying freely between the two saxophonists. It's not surprising these two men, known for their wit and love of wordplay, would create an album with such counterpoint and clever back and forth. Incidentally, Two of a Mind is a contrafact on one of Desmond's favorite tunes, Look for the Silver Lining. Between 1961 and 1965, Desmond and Jim Hall went into the studio for RCA 19 times in total, which resulted in five complete albums. The first of these releases, which all quickly followed their recording sessions, was Take 10, on which Desmond hoped in vain to have a follow-up hit to the success he found with Take 5. It's a bit crazy, really. Like, you have this kind of, you know, fluke hit with Take 5, and you're like, I'll just write another one in a weird time, and we'll call it Take 10, like twice as much. It's double as good. It'll be a hit, right? Yeah, it's chasing the dragon a bit, right? The album, which did not meet Desmond's commercial hopes, does feature four bossa novas, which is a sound that, you know, Jim Hall was one of the first American musicians to export from Brazil, or import from Brazil, I suppose we should say. It's a natural form for Desmond's sound, and the style and the sympathetic relationship between Hall and Desmond is on full display on this album. It's kind of interesting to think of the bossa nova as being a novel concept, since in its various forms, it has become so ingrained in American music. Desmond lamented that it was too bad that, quote, bossa nova became such a hula hoop promotion, unquote, which I think refers to like what I call gringo bosses, a phenomenon that Desmond undoubtedly contributed to, you know, even though he's complaining about it. He goes on to say, quote, "The original feeling was really a wild, subtle, delicate thing, but it got lost there for a while in the avalanche. It's much too musical to be just a fad. It should be a permanent part of the scene. One more color for the long winter night and all," unquote. Bossa Antigua was the follow-up album to Take 10 and naturally features tunes that are all more or less in a bossa nova style. In his liner notes for the album, Desmond refers to himself as, quote, "the John P. Marquand of the alto saxophone," unquote, which is a reference that will probably require a little bit of explaining, but it's worth the diversion because I think it shows a high level of self-awareness on Desmond's part. Marquand was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose social commentary in publications like the Saturday Evening Post was considered by many to be quite slick. Which is similar to criticisms of Desmond's very polished alto style. Further, in novels, Marquand often wrote satirically of upper-crust society, though he ultimately ended up joining those rarefied circles, which strikes me as having similarities to Desmond's deliberate efforts to sort of stand out from the jazz elite, i.e. Charlie Parker, even though that originality is what cemented his legacy as a member of the jazz elite. It's a wonderful example of the kind of urbane, subtle thinking that was really at the core of Desmond's existence, you know, comparing himself to Marquand. Samba Cepeda, toward the end of the album, is named for Orlando Cepeda, who was a seven-time All-Star power hitter for the San Francisco Giants, who was known to be a great lover of jazz and Latin music. On a side note, Orlando Cepeda is just a fascinating character to look into if you get a chance. He was a great power hitter who, after retirement, was convicted of drug trafficking charges, then became a practicing Buddhist, and now has a concession stand called Orlando's Caribbean Barbecue at Oracle Park in San Francisco, which, by the way, is hands down the nicest baseball stadium I've ever been to. Anyway, bit of a digression, but that's who the tomb is named for, Samba Cepeda, for Orlando Cepeda. The two men didn't know each other, as far as I'm aware, but Desmond was a big baseball fan, and, you know, the Giants are his hometown team. Alianza was another Desmond original, but the title was created by Gloria Steinem and was named after the Kennedy administration's Alliance for Progress, a 10-year plan aimed at fostering economic ties with South America to counter the perceived and now clearly absurd threat of communism from Cuba. Curaçao Doloroso was based on the 1931 tune Heartaches, though Desmond reharmonized the tune and then wrote a new melody based on those changes. So Heartaches was really more of a sort of starting point. About the source material, Desmond said, quote, "Since it's a different melody and a different set of chords, the writers of Heartaches won't be around looking for royalties. But if they ever feel like popping by for a drink, I'm usually home between 4 and 6, unquote. At this point in his career, which is about 1963, Desmond was doing quite well financially, largely due to the great volume of sales that Take 5 was generating. That year, he sent his parents $3,000 with instructions to buy something frivolous with it. Unfortunately, Paul's father, Emil, would die the following year in 1964, prompting Desmond to fly home to San Francisco during a trip to Jamaica. Though Paul would continue close correspondence with his mother, she would die only a few years later. With both parents gone, Desmond's ties to the West Coast were pretty much formally severed. If it wasn't already, New York had become his adopted home at the age of 41. Through the next few years of the mid-60s, the Brubeck Group toured and recorded extensively. On the recording side, the group did many tribute albums, including to composers Leonard Bernstein, Matt Dennis, and Richard Rodgers. They also made several acclaimed live recordings, such as 1967's Mexico concert. The Dave Brubeck Quartet formally disbanded at the end of 1967. It's kind of odd because the guys had made their decision in advance and were openly talking about it with people. Desmond described to Herb Geller how no one really spoke to each other anymore and that they weren't enemies or anything like that. Rather, quote, "After 17 years, we've heard what everybody wants to say, so we just don't talk," unquote. I can kind of relate to that. You know, when you've been in a group, especially traveling, like you're just constantly up each other's asses, right? And you're just like, we've had enough. You know, it doesn't matter how great it is. Like, we just need, you know, you need fresh air, you need greener pastures, you need to just get some space sometimes. The last performance of the classic Dave Brubeck Quartet took place in Pittsburgh on December 26, 1967, though the group would reunite some years later. According to Joe Morello, Desmond had a habit of taking advantage of Brubeck's good nature, especially toward the end of the group. He missed concerts or showed up late, usually as a result of bouts of heavy drinking. Morello described him as, quote, "the big bad boy of the group," unquote, which I find a little funny. The last few months had indeed been rough, with Desmond clearly acting out while the group was on tour in Europe. Whilst in Hamburg, Desmond disappeared to the Reeperbahn district and ended up missing multiple concerts due to drunkenness and a refusal to be found or to get out of bed. It seems it was almost like some kind of weird game that he played with himself, like just sort of, how drunk can I get? Except that it didn't really matter what happened to him or if he got too drunk and missed dates. Like, you know, he's a successful, rich musician. Like, people just let you get away with that, I guess. The other thing that was really weird about this behavior was that he was totally capable of going on these benders and still making travel calls and sounding brilliant when he wanted to, such as the Paris concert, which followed one of his Reeperbahn outings and was recorded and released as "The Last Time We Saw Paris." That's the title of it. You know, he goes out in this big bender in Hamburg. He must be wrecked, you know, and he just plays brilliantly. This is a bit of an aside, but it's kind of funny, so just go with me. According to Jim Hall, Desmond, of all people, helped Hall to stop drinking. Hall and Desmond became extremely good friends, both on and off the bandstand, but early on in their relationship, when Hall was on his way to becoming a known guitar player on the LA scene in the late 50s, Desmond went to see him at the club with, frankly, the best name ever, Shelley's Man Hall. And Hall was, he's like pounding down Manhattans. And Desmond was so outraged by his choice of drink that he called Hall's future wife, Jane, and told her, quote, "You better help Jim, he's drinking Manhattans," unquote. Jane eventually did help Hall to get sober, and, you know, so there you have it. Desmond, heavy drinker that he was, actually helped Jim Hall to clean up his act. Small caveat in that, I guess. I'm pretty sure that Desmond was only outraged at Hall's choice of drink, not the quantity that he was drinking. A young woman that Desmond briefly dated in New York described his kitchen as having cabinets filled with cartons of cigarettes and bottles of scotch and nothing else. She describes getting up in the middle of the night to find something to eat, and there's like nothing but spoiled milk in the fridge and the aforementioned scotch and cigarettes in the cupboards. Back to the story. Following the breakup of the Dave Brubeck Quartet, the group's two soloists took very different paths. Brubeck, always industrious and with a sober focus, began realizing a number of large-scale works that he had been scheming for a while, including several works in sort of like an oratorio or cantata format, such as The Light in the Wilderness, The Gates of Justice, and The Truth Is Fallen. He also wrote an Easter oratorio and a Christmas cantata. It should also be noted that Brubeck continued to play many small group gigs, either as a trio or with Jerry Mulligan, basically replacing Desmond. For his part, Desmond took a somewhat different path, pretending to write a book tentatively titled How Many of You Are There in a Quartet?, which was to be about his time with the Brubeck group, and while he claimed to be doing this, he was secretly using this as a ruse, just as an excuse to hang out with real writers at Elaine's, you know, which was a restaurant on the Upper East Side. It's not there anymore. Elaine's was a social hub frequented by many writers and other creatives like Tom Wolfe, Norman Mailer, Woody Allen, Nora Ephron, John Cassavetes, and others. Desmond also spent a lot of time vacationing in Jamaica. Throughout 1968, Desmond did very little outside of his leisure pursuits, except for make one very notable recording for A&M Records titled Summertime. The album largely features Brazilian and other Latin treatments of a variety of tunes and has a pretty heavy cast of sidemen. Herbie Hancock, and I'm pretty sure it's Ron Carter, round out the rhythm section, and J.J. Johnson and Bill Waitress are playing in the brass section, along with a number of New York studio heavies. And the album received really kind words and 4 stars from Dan Morgenstern in his Downbeat review. Aside from this recording, Desmond played rarely in public for what can fairly be called his leisure years, following the dissolution of the Brubeck Quartet. He did come out of quasi-retirement a couple of times for rather notable performances, however. One of these was a rather strange affair put together by the Nixon administration. Apparently, several of Nixon's advisors were great jazz fans and even semi-professional performers themselves. Leonard Garment, who was a former law partner of Nixon, played tenor saxophone with Woody Herman, actually. These guys basically convinced Nixon that he should honor Duke Ellington with the Presidential Medal of Freedom and throw a great event to honor the pianist and composer on his 70th birthday. The band that was assembled for the event featured Desmond alongside the likes of Jerry Mulligan, Clark Terry, J.J. Johnson, Hank Jones, Jim Hall, and Louis Belson, and like loads more. Dave Brubeck was also a featured pianist. Apparently, Spiro Agnew even played Sophisticated Lady and In a Sentimental Mood at the cocktail party. I guess villainous political figures were just classier in those days. I don't know. Doug Ramsey describes the event as, quote, the greatest jazz happening ever held at the White House, unquote, which is just so crazy to me that that happened during the Nixon administration. Apparently, Nixon himself accompanied the crowd of over 180 on the piano in the East Room whilst they sang Happy Birthday to Ellington. It's kind of interesting to me that Desmond and many of the other musicians would agree to play for such an event hosted by the Nixon administration. Sure, you might say that on such an occasion, musicians and politicians should be able to put politics aside and come together to celebrate a truly great American composer and musician in Duke Ellington. And indeed, the concert was a clear example of this. However, in the weeks following the event, Nixon decided that he wanted to release the recording of the event as a document of the great night of music. His administration arranged for CBS Records to distribute it essentially free of charge and asked all of the musicians to consent to releasing it for free, and with the agreement that all of the proceeds would be going to the Musicians Union Trust Fund and the Billy Strayhorn Scholarship Foundation. Paul Desmond and Jim Hall were among several musicians who refused to give consent for the release to be made, largely over political differences. In addition to political protestations, Desmond was also displeased with one of his features, Chelsea Bridge, during which the bass player fumbled the changes quite severely. Years later, after Desmond's death, the release was finally made with Jim Hall consenting, as long as the packaging did not praise the Nixon administration in any way. Desmond would have been displeased to find his recording of Chelsea Bridge with the botched accompaniment on the record, despite originally having been promised that they would leave that out. You know, the Nixon team was like, "We want to release this. If you're not happy with it, we'll leave that out, but we'll release the rest of it." But years later, they just put it out anyway. In addition to the Ellington Honors Concert, Desmond played at the New Orleans Jazz Festival in 1969, which seems to sort of be known as like one of the finest presentations of jazz music in the, you know, kind of festival format. Desmond performed with Jerry Mulligan, and the festival also featured the likes of Count Basie, Sarah Vaughan, Roland Kirk, Clark Terry, Dizzy Gillespie, and, you know, just like loads of other incredible players and local marching bands and just great stuff. Doug Ramsey, who was lucky enough to hang out with Desmond and many of these great players throughout the festival, describes hanging out, like trying to close down bars in the French Quarter and just sitting on the like balconies, you know, with Desmond and Basie and these other great musicians, like watching the sunrise. It just sounds incredible. Also during 1969, Desmond recorded From the Hot Afternoon, which is one of my personal favorites. And he also recorded Bridge Over Troubled Water, which is also quite lovely, if a little on the cheesy side. And I mean that in the nicest way. You know, give it a listen. You'll see what I mean. Both of these records were made for A&R Records. From the Hot Afternoon features six tunes by Milton Nascimento, whom Desmond had hoped to be able to record with. But unfortunately, it wasn't meant to be for this date. But Desmond did manage to get six of his tunes. And the others are composed by another Brazilian, Edu Lobo, who was available and actually did play guitar on the record. Bridge Over Troubled Water is, as you might imagine, a reimagining of Paul Simon's songs. The arrangements on this album, many of which carry Simon's tunes in sort of Brazilian styles, are quite lush, and were it not for the sincerity that Desmond plays with, as well as the integrity coming from both Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter in the rhythm section, they would probably come across as maybe a bit saccharine. Listening to this record, I think it's such a strong statement that Desmond made by choosing to play the way he did. He had such a strong vision for how he wanted to sound, and I think it's just abundantly clear on this album. Listen to the very opening phrases that he plays. They're so simple, so clear, and so direct. It's a choice. It's to me, it's just such a clear and obvious vision of what he wanted to sound like. It's just wonderful. During the early 70s, Desmond played a live concert with the Modern Jazz Quartet at Town Hall, which would be released years later on the Finesse label. He also did sporadic dates with Dave Brubeck from time to time. Though Brubeck was largely focused on his large-scale works, he would from time to time take rather lucrative offers to perform in small group settings. Frequently, he would hire Jerry Mulligan, but every now and then, Desmond would do some of the dates. Eventually, Brubeck's sons and some of their circle of friends came to be involved with these dates, which were then called Two Generations of Brubeck. Most of Desmond's life during the early 70s seems to have been based around dinner parties, Elaine's, Bradley's, and just generally skulking around the village at like all night with Carl Gurevich, newspapers tucked under their arms to disguise themselves as early morning workers rather than drunken stay-outs. As the 70s progressed, Desmond came out of his semi-retirement to become a more active player again, however. Desmond recorded music for a play called Turtlenecks, which ran for about a month in 1973. Tony Curtis, who starred in the production, described it as a disaster, though through no fault of Desmond's. Desmond recorded four tunes, including There'll Never Be Another You, and also like a bunch of stabs, sound effects, and like general underscoring, which was then played, recorded throughout the show. Stanley Walden, who was the composer tasked with providing the music for the show, described Desmond as seeming like puzzled by the project the whole time, as if he didn't really like understand it, like it didn't make sense to him what he was doing. It's a little strange to me that this project would have seemed so weird to Desmond, because he was an avid theater goer his whole life and was working in basically the same, you know, alto guitar based drums context that he was used to in the 70s. You'd think it would be kind of a natural project for him, but who knows? I don't know. Just didn't make sense to him. In 1973, Desmond recorded the album Skylark at Rudy Van Gelder's studios for Creed Taylor's new label, CTI. Launched a few years prior as a subsidiary of A&M, CTI became independent in 1970, and Taylor was quick to sign Freddie Hubbard, Stanley Turrentine, Hubert Laws, and of course Paul Desmond. The album features Gabor Szabo on guitar. He's a Hungarian guitar player, Hungarian-American, which was a choice made by Taylor in order to put Desmond into a sort of slightly different context than he had been working with recently. Szabo was a self-taught guitarist from Hungary who incorporated a lot of influence from rock musicians. In a way, he kind of reflects the next generation of jazz guitar players, of which many, you know, are well-versed in rock styles. The guitar sounds on this album are indeed brighter and more edgy than the recordings with Jim Hall, but it's still very much a conventional Desmond record, albeit with sort of spacier, rock-tinged guitar solos. You know, he kind of plays with these long, sustained notes. It very much comes out of a rock thing. As Ramsey points out, this kind of guitar playing works really well on the first half of the album on tunes like Take 10, which are really pretty simple and repetitive harmonically. The electric piano of Bob James and Ron Carter's, you know, kind of droning, rubbery bass lines also lend themselves well to this context. Jack DeJohnette is the drummer on the record. Later, in 1975, CTI would put out Jim Hall's Concierto, which also featured Desmond and Chet Baker. In 1972, the Half Note Club moved north to Midtown, basically just a few blocks away from Desmond's residence. The owner, Sonny Cantorino, was a big fan of Desmond's and had made it known that if the saxophonist was willing, he had a job at the club. Desmond had been mulling it over and occasionally mentioning it to friends, you know, that he might start playing there. And finally, in 1974, he decided that he was ready, and he went in with Jim Hall, Ron Carter, and Ben Reilly. Even though it was the first time Desmond had worked as a leader since his days at the Bandbox some 25 years earlier, the two-week engagement was a hit, attracting large crowds each evening. During this engagement, Bill Evans played opposite Desmond and his quartet. I mean, it's a pretty killer lineup. You could go to the half note and see alternating sets of Bill Evans and Paul Desmond with Jim Hall, Ron Carter. Incredible. With the successful half note gig done and dusted, Desmond was offered a two-week stint at a club called Bourbon Street in Toronto, for which he would have to find a new rhythm section. He hired guitarist Ed Bickert, who would come to be another close musical companion, much like Jim Hall. And he also hired Don Thompson on bass and Jerry Fuller on drums. The group immediately slipped into a comfortable way of working with very little forethought, and mostly Desmond just sort of like calling tunes on the bandstand. You know, Desmond was not really one to do a lot of rehearsing or forethought or anything, so finding really compatible musicians that he could just kind of, you know, call standards or whatever and launch into things was really comfortable for him and inspiring, and that's the way he liked to work. Desmond so enjoyed working with these Canadian musicians that he would refer to them as the Canadian group for the rest of his years. He enjoyed playing with Ed Bickert so much that he convinced Creed Taylor to fly him to New York to record his next record for CTI with Ron Carter and Connie Kay. That one was to be called Pure Desmond. Weirdly, Creed Taylor didn't like the results of the record at all and nearly shelved it, which is ironic since it's regarded now as really a highlight in Desmond's discography. Taylor's main objection to the record was that Connie Kay's drumming was too simple, and he even attempted to have Mel Lewis overdub some new drum tracks, but because of the way the studio was set up, there was just too much bleed from the original to make the overdubs work. In the end, Taylor was convinced to release the record as it stood, and the liner notes to this album is where Desmond's most famous line about wanting to sound like a dry martini comes from. So that's from the album Pure Desmond. In 1975, a chance duet performance between Desmond and Brubeck led to what I think is really my favorite Desmond recording. Desmond boarded the SS Rotterdam for a jazz cruise to Bermuda with the two generations of Brubeck outfit that featured Brubeck's sons, in the rhythm section. One night, as they were rehearsing before the concert, they realized that they didn't really have time to like run through a ballad that they were going to play with, and the younger players didn't know the tune. So Desmond and Brubeck just decided that they would just play it as a duet, right? Just saxophone and piano. It's kind of weird that in all of their years playing together, it had never really occurred to either of them that they might just do some duo playing. They did the piece as a duet in the concert and both felt like really strongly about it. So they repeated the idea the next two nights to largely the same effect. And they liked it. The BBC was on board and recorded the concerts, and both men were surprised by how much they liked the recordings as well. You know how sometimes like you play something live and you think, wow, that was great. And then you listen back to it and it's like, it's not so great, or it's okay, you know. But they played it live, loved it, and listened back to the recording and really liked it. So this eventually led to the recording of the Duets album, which features much of the standard Brubeck quartet repertoire, but reworked in a more simple manner. And one of the things I like about that album is it has kind of standard tunes, which saxophone and piano, no big deal. Like, that's a pretty normal thing. But also, they do the Kodo song from Jazz Impressions of Japan, which is kind of a wild composition, and it doesn't really, it's not like a standard tune. It doesn't lend itself that way, but they play it beautifully there, and Paul Desmond's like doing these key clacks and these wind sounds at the beginning. It's just lovely. In 1976, the classic Brubeck Quartet got back together for a 25-day, 25-city tour. This time, they wouldn't be traveling in Brubeck's old beat-up car, and they had a custom-made tour bus with beds, kitchen, entertainment systems, the works, basically. The tour featured the two generations of Brubeck outfit, as well as the original quartet, who, to Brubeck's surprise, all eagerly agreed to the operation, saying that they'd all really missed playing together. While musically successful and a big hit with audiences, the aging musicians began to show a bit of wear and tear as the tour progressed. Joe Morello, who had struggled with his vision throughout his life, basically went blind during one performance. He described his vision as going green and bubbly and then just fading to darkness. He had to leave the tour to see a specialist in Boston, and after the tour, Desmond booked himself in for some medical tests following swollen ankles, but was relieved to find that his liver, which he figured was the problem, was in remarkably good health. Unfortunately, a chest x-ray showed a spot on his lung. His 3-pack-a-day had resulted in lung cancer. This is where the famous quote, "One of the great livers of our time, awash, endures, and full of health," came from. And that was Desmond's, you know, sort of witty response to learning of his cancer diagnosis. At 51 years old, Desmond was given 6 months to live if he started chemotherapy immediately. So he began doing rounds of chemo, which would knock him out of commission for a couple of days after each treatment. He continued to perform with his Canadian group, including a trip to the West Coast for Jimmy Lyon's Monterey Festival. Rumors circulated that the hometown kid, gone off into the world and made a name for himself, was back in town, and this might be it. The chemo was clearly taking a toll on his appearance, and Desmond was still smoking heavily despite the diagnosis. Back in New York, on his 52nd birthday, which was also Thanksgiving Day, Jim Hall's daughter cooked dinner for her parents and a very ailing Desmond in her cramped first apartment in New York. It would be Desmond's last birthday dinner. During the holiday season, Desmond reconnected with the Brubecks, as well as with Jerry Mulligan, and for the first time, donned a series of toupees. Over the previous decade or so, he had been steadily losing his hair, but he always refused to wear any sort of artificial hair. The rapid loss of hair from the chemotherapy and probably the thought that he would soon be dead led him to try a few styles of toupees, which he loved and wondered why he hadn't tried them earlier. Jack Richardson suggested that the toupee looked as though it, quote, had been dropped from 20 feet above and landed on his head, unquote. Despite the telltale signs of ailing health and dodgy toupees, Desmond insisted that only close friends know of his condition and that there was no attention from the press. Despite the pain and presumably fear that he was living with as he was dying, Desmond kept up a dignified existence, and those around him don't recall any whining, complaining, or otherwise really acknowledging his illness. There are many tales of his close friends like Carl Gervich attempting to bribe doctors at Mount Sinai to take special care of him or smuggling in airplane bottles of Dewar's scotch, you know, so that he could, you know, keep living the way he liked to live. Toward the very end, when the chemotherapy was taking a heavy toll on Desmond's energy levels, he was still attempting to perform, somewhat miraculously. He did several dates with Brubeck and his sons, and when needed, got blood transfusions prior to performances to boost his energy levels. At Lincoln Center, Desmond had multiple transfusions as well as a chair in the wings to sit on when he wasn't playing. Brubeck described the green room as being, quote, like a wake with the person they're waking sitting there, unquote. At the Lincoln Center concert, Desmond played short solos, which his friends remember as being full of humor and wit and very much in his typical style, if a bit brief. They described the audience as being a bit unforgiving. You know, the public didn't know about his condition, and it's quite sad to think of him. He's playing his dying notes. He's sounding great, but he just doesn't have the stamina to play his usual sort of quantity. He sounds great, but he's playing two choruses or something instead of, you know, 4, 5, 6 choruses of brilliant stuff. And the audience, ignorant of the suffering which he was undergoing from the chemo, you know, is less than odd on that occasion. Like they just want a little more. And it's just really sad to think about that. Following the Lincoln Center concert, Desmond managed to do a few takes in the studio with Chet Baker. I've heard that session described as two men who are basically ghosts of their former selves, kind of like drifting about in the studio for as long as their stamina could hold out. Both played brilliantly, despite their ailing health. When putting together his final will and sorting out the residual rights to his recordings and work with the Brubeck Group, which importantly included the rights to Take Five, Desmond's lawyer, Noel Silverman, suggested to Desmond that it was important that he figure out who he wanted to leave the rights to his recorded legacy and publishing rights to, as they would continue to generate significant income for years to come. Desmond clearly had not thought this through and instructed his lawyer to put the Red Cross down as the beneficiary in the short term while he considered to whom he wanted to leave his legacy. Paul Desmond died several months later on May 30th, 1977, having never updated the will, therefore leaving everything to the Red Cross. Desmond had decided that he wanted no funeral and instead wanted his ashes to be spread over Big Sur. Jimmy Lyons did the honors, mixing a pitcher of martinis with the urn full of ashes and spreading them from a small plain over the rugged section of the California coast so loved by Desmond. Though Desmond wanted no funeral or memorial service of any type, his friends inevitably put together a few events on either coast. The Brubecks hosted a small gathering on the West Coast, and Noel Silverman, Carl Gurevich, and Bradley Cunningham brought together a rather large group of Desmond's friends at the Columbia Records studio on 30th Street in Manhattan. They had scoured Desmond's address books and personal effects to find the contact info for his disparate groups of friends. Part of the reason Desmond didn't want any sort of like memorial service was because he kept his friends so strictly compartmentalized. And shortly before he died, he told Jenna Cox that it would just be a nightmare to bring all these different people together. Or that's how he felt anyway. Everyone who attended the New York gathering described it as lovely and touching. But there were people there who knew each other, who were surprised to learn that the other knew Paul Desmond. You know, wouldn't that be wild? Like you see your friend there, like someone you've known and you didn't even know that you had this mutual friend and they had this relationship. And for some reason, you know, Desmond put these walls in between these relationships. It's just an example of the extraordinary way that he kept his life compartmentalized. Though money, possessions, instruments, and other things like Rolexes went to specific people that Desmond knew, his most economically valuable possession, the residuary rights to Take Five and his other compositions, did in fact go to the Red Cross. By 2002, the Desmond estate had sent more than $3 million to the Red Cross and received scant and impersonal thanks from the organization. The Red Cross didn't even add Desmond or his estate to their year-end list of significant donors each year. Silverman, tasked with executing Desmond's will, sent an angry letter which began a sincere apology from the Red Cross and culminated in a posthumous event, a posthumous tribute at their annual dinner dance in 2003, which was accepted by Silverman. In his acceptance speech for the award, Silverman mentioned that the Desmond estate had, by that point, given over $4 million to the Red Cross. He described how, just as it's incredibly important to society that organizations like the Red Cross are supported, we must also support musicians, artists, writers, and the like. Not just because the legacies of their great works live on to fund important charities, but as Silverman said, quote, "We are who we are because of them. We cannot easily do without organizations like the Red Cross, and we fail to support them at our peril. But the same is equally, if not more true, of our artistic community. Honoring the Paul Desmonds of the world is not a luxury. It is a necessity." Unquote. In describing to architect Raphael Vinoli how he wanted the large performance space at the soon-to-be-built Jazz at Lincoln Center, artistic director Wynton Marsalis said that the room should sound, quote, like Lester Young, Billie Holiday, Paul Desmond, and Miles Davis. In other words, the room should sound warm, golden, and light, unquote. So that's basically the Paul Desmond story, but I thought it'd be fun to go through a few more Paul Desmond tales, you know, that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path. According to the photographer William Claxton, who, by the way, I've come to realize is maybe like the best authority on jazz stories. You know, he was this great photographer, so he was like always on the scene when things were happening, and just had a mind for like documenting things. So he's just got all this great stuff. He's got great books. But anyway, Claxton says everyone was smoking pot in the 50s except for Desmond. He was a heavy cigarette smoker and he drank martinis. He still had his occasional Benzedrine habit as well. Brubeck tells the story of the band having dinner before a gig in Manchester, England, weirdly, where I live, and Desmond was drinking martinis. Eventually the waiter got tired of making the continual trips to the bar, so he just brought the bottle of gin to the table and marked it. Brubeck estimates that Desmond had about 20 martinis that night, then walked across the street and played brilliantly. He was a very high-functioning heavy drinker. In addition to being a heavy drinker, Desmond was a heavy smoker. Brubeck, who had developed an allergy to cigarette smoke, would not allow Desmond to smoke when they were in a car together or in their small chartered airplanes. And one time when they landed to refuel, the guys jumped out to stretch their legs and Desmond to smoke. And Brubeck told him not to light up right next to where the plane was refueling because, well, you know, jet fuel and all. And Desmond, quote, jumped up and down like Rumpelstiltskin and said, I've been in that damn airplane for 4 hours with you and I didn't smoke. And here I am outside just waiting to smoke and you tell me not to, unquote. Also, on the matter of his smoking, one of Desmond's final letters to his mother contained a brief passage where he told her that his father had tried to convince him to give up the habit. Desmond claimed his father, who had recently quit himself, was looking for a, quote, companion in misery, unquote. He also described how the look on his face when I lit a cigarette was so heartbreaking, I had to stop. It was like eating in front of starving children. Desmond was known as a ladies' man all of his life, possibly on par with the notorious Duke Ellington, according to George Vakian. Desmond made it a personal project to get to know all of the beautiful women who frequently graced the covers of his albums. And Avakian said that Desmond would frequently accept invitations to the producer's Central Park apartment with a different young lady on his arm each time. Though women seemed to have basically thrown themselves at him, he was not one for locker room talk and rarely spoke of any of his romantic activities. Arriving late and without a hotel at the Newport Festival one year, Avakian offered Desmond the spare bed in his room. And in the morning, he left the notoriously late sleeper in bed, and Avakian recalls nearly tripping over a young woman outside the door to his room who asked, is Paul awake? Avakian replied that he didn't know who Paul was and received the reply, well, I think he's in that room, and I'm going to stay out here until he comes out. When Avakian asked Desmond about it later, he was told that she was still there at 9 when Desmond got up the first time, and again at noon, still waiting when he got up the second time. Avakian asked him, you know, what happened? To which Desmond replied, oh, nothing. I know how to get rid of them. Another humorous incident with a young lady is recounted by Diana Wilcoe in Doug Ramsey's book. Diana was just finishing high school as Take 5 was becoming a major hit, and she developed a big-time crush on Desmond. She somehow had his address, and she wrote him a Christmas card explaining that she was studying art and how someday when she becomes a successful artist, she would like to do a cover for one of his albums. Incidentally, Wilcoe did become a really successful graphic designer. But in the Christmas card, she explained what the album cover would look like. It was to be black and white with images of girls sort of dancing euphorically around Desmond. And she said that she would use Optima type font because according to her, Optima was his font. At Valentine's Day, Desmond sent Wilco a dozen long-stemmed roses with a poem that read, "Roses are red, violets are blue, optima schmoptima, my type is you." Obviously, Wilco was just like thrilled to receive this response. And so at St. Patrick's Day, being the next holiday, she sent him a card with a cut-up picture of her in a bathing suit. And the note said, "I go all to pieces of myself when I hear you play." Shortly after that, Desmond called and asked for a date, which occurred the next day at Charlie O's. I imagine that Desmond was probably receiving like a lot of this kind of like fan mail, you know, and I wonder if this response that he gave was typical, or if it was like a one-off thing. Or maybe he was just using all of this fan mail from young ladies as a, you know, kind of like dating service or something. It's very funny to me to think about him doing that. Another side note, Ramsey published images of these cards in his book, and it's clear that Diana Wilco was a very talented graphic designer from a young age. And looking at the cards, it's pretty clear to me that they would have appealed to Desmond's wit and humor. I can imagine him opening them and being really taken aback, like, whoa, I got to meet this girl. Brubeck tells the story of the only time he, or probably anyone for that matter, saw Desmond run. The quartet was invited to play at the Indiana Jazz Festival in Evansville alongside the Paul Winter Sextet and Duke Ellington. The festival was put together by some sort of oil baron who invited all of the musicians back to his home for a party, and he just like put Desmond and Brubeck in a car with a driver and instructions on how to find the house. He told him, "You'll likely beat me there, so you know, just let yourself in." Upon arriving, the pair found the house dark, and so Brubeck began climbing through a window Desmond began climbing through an open window on the ground level, when suddenly the lights turned on and a man with a shotgun came down the stairs. Brubeck shouted, "Run like hell, Paul! We've got the wrong house!" And that was when he saw the rare sight of Desmond actually running. Another story of Desmond having to rush somewhere comes from the mid-60s, when the Brubeck Quartet was mostly playing concerts and doing a lot of campus dates. Frequently, they weren't really touring, but traveling to bigger dates as, you know, sort of like one-off engagements. Desmond, ever the late sleeper, failed to make the travel call at LaGuardia, and a furious Brubeck told him that he'd just have to find his own way to get to Greenville, South Carolina. Desmond chartered a private jet. Yes, apparently there was a time when jazz musicians could charter private jets to gigs, and arrived at the completely closed down airport in Greenville. The pilot said he had to leave because the light was going, and so he just left Desmond in a hangar that happened to have a couple who was like making out in there because they were alone. The problem was that the gig was actually in Greensboro, North Carolina. Desmond claimed for the rest of his life that Brubeck had told him the wrong city on purpose to set him up. In the end, after explaining his plight, he convinced the couple to drive him to the gig and arrived furious with Brubeck. Gloria Steinem recalled that Desmond referred to himself as the Library Lion, which was a reference to the statues that sit outside the main library on 42nd Street and look out over the world. Desmond felt that he was a watcher of life and not really a participant. In those days, Desmond claimed that he could write a guide of every restaurant in his neighborhood that was quiet and had enough light to read. Desmond's social circle was not limited to those in his immediate neighborhood, and he was known to be a prodigious maker of long-distance calls, which were extremely expensive in the 60s and 70s. Always one to celebrate new technologies, Desmond came into the possession of a phone freaker, which is a device that allowed a caller to get around paying fees for long-distance calls by tricking the phone company's switchboards. Desmond was a heavy user of this little blue box until the actor Robert Cummings was arrested in Seattle, which prompted him to cease and desist using it. At a rather formal dinner party honoring the quartet following a performance in Bavaria, where each musician was assigned to a table with guests, Desmond's German hosts asked him if he was German, you know, when they found out that his real last name was Breitenfeld. He replied that his grandparents emigrated from Bohemia, to which his guests replied, "Interesting, where is that?" Desmond replied with an all-time great German burn, quote, "I thought you knew. You had it last," unquote. So that's the end of the Paul Desmond anecdotes. I want to close with a few thoughts on Desmond's playing in general, and this is a section that I'm calling The Mystery of Paul Desmond's Sound. I think that Paul Desmond had the single most identifiable sound of any saxophonist ever. Big claim, right? Maybe that's reductive, but I can't think of any other player that you can pin down with just one note, regardless of context or what they're playing, as easily as Paul Desmond. Sure, Train, Sanborn, Ornette, a few others are easy to identify, but none come close to Desmond in terms of consistently delivering a singularly specific personal sound, in my opinion. But what is it that made his sound? We know it's not equipment. Both Desmond and Cannonball Adderley used Gregory mouthpieces, though I think Cannonball is more known for playing on Myers later, maybe. Desmond played a Selmer saxophone, like literally everyone else. We all play him, right? I think his early focus on clarinet playing clearly had an impact on his sound concept. In early letters to his dad, he spoke about how he heard the clarinet sound he wanted being clear and clean. The general light touch of vibrato or frequently straight tone that Desmond used also suggests a strong influence from the clarinet. Though the clarinet players that Desmond admired, like Benny Goodman, certainly used a lot of vibrato. Hal Strack recalled a lesson that Desmond took early on with Herb Lorden, who was playing lead alto with Gus Arnheim, in which Lorden told him to tune his instrument slightly sharp in order to give him natural brilliance. I'm thoroughly convinced that setting your instrument up to play slightly on the high side of the pitch is fundamental to good saxophone playing, because it allows you to relax down into the pitch and play with a more round sound. And it also means that you're really only adjusting your intonation in one direction rather than, you know, trying to bring some notes up and other notes down. My theory is that since Desmond favored the upper register so much in his playing, by setting up his horn slightly sharp, the high notes, which are naturally very sharp on the saxophone, would have needed extreme voicing control to bring them down to pitch, which I believe is where the magic in Desmond's tone comes from. I think this quote from Desmond about mouthpieces is probably really good advice for any saxophone player. Quote, "Get a good, medium mouthpiece that blows good and stays pretty much in tune. Then stick with it for 5 years and you can do anything you want on it. Keep changing, you just get in a squirrel cage." Unquote. In addition to his tone, the way that Desmond played was equally crucial to his success. I believe that his focus on economy is what made his style work. Playing with a bird-like intensity with that tone wouldn't have worked, nor would playing clean and clear ideas with a less sophisticated sound. Desmond's frequent register shifts, quotations, and absolute mastery of antecedent consequent phrasing is every bit as integral to his playing as his dry martini sound. It's quite remarkable, in my opinion, that Desmond, in a world obsessed with the developments of Charlie Parker, had such a clear vision and belief in that vision to pursue his own vision of jazz. In a way, his playing makes me think of the French painter Robert Delaunay, who painted large geometric shapes in bright colors. For both Desmond and Delaunay, the economy and simplicity of the raw elements involved in their compositions can betray the complexity and sophistication of the vision of the work taken in total. Again, I'd like to thank Doug Ramsey for his book, Take Five, The Public and Private Lives of Paul Desmond. It's a really great read, and there's so much fun stuff in there, like letters between Paul and his father and other correspondence, and there's like a story where he's like telling off the building association and just all this weird stuff. Like it's like 1,000 pages long and it's just packed with great stuff. Like I can't recommend checking it out enough. Thanks very much for listening. Please like and subscribe and do all those things and get in touch. I haven't really decided who I'm going to cover for the next episode. So, you know, if you got somebody you want to hear about, get in touch, you know, via my website, andrewdmeyer.com. That's M-E-Y-E-R. I've had a few listeners like write in and we've started some nice email conversations and stuff. So love to do that. But thank you very much. And we'll see you next time on the Saxophone History Podcast.